nature takes forever, that time seems imponderably long, and the earth seems inconceivably huge, the future seems very, very far away. And he writes in the beginning of his book, our comforting sense of the permanence of our natural world, our confidence that it will change gradually and imperceptibly, if at all, is then the result of a subtly warped perspective. Changes that can affect not just changes like wars, but bigger and more sweeping events. He says, I believe that without recognizing it, we have already stepped over a threshold of such a change that we are at the end of nature. As we talk here this morning with Bill McKibben, you are certainly invited to call in. The local number here is 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. McKibben, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us some more about what you mean by the end of nature.
Sure. The book really is as much as anything a discussion of the greenhouse effect. As you and your listeners, I'm sure, know, there are now a lot of scientists and politicians and things who believe that in the course of the next century, our exhaust gases and burning rainforests and things will raise the temperature, I don't know, 3 to 9 degrees. So I talk about a lot of the physical effects of that, possible physical effects, but also am very interested in the kind of, you might say, philosophical effects of that. What does it mean if in 20 years I walk out my back door, which opens onto 100,000 acres of pretty pristine wilderness, and the temperature is 70 degrees instead of 65 because of all our car exhausts and things? It seems to me that then one's standing in the equivalent of a heated room, and that in a way it makes very little sense to talk about the wild anymore, that we will have managed to tame the whole surface of the globe in some way, and that strikes me as an important threshold that we will have stepped over.
Yeah. You write about it in the sense that we have almost always defined nature by saying that it is something that is completely apart from us. It's independent from us, and that now with the changes in the climate on a global scale, there is no place on Earth really where nature is untouched by the work of humans.
Yes, or may soon be.
Yeah,
that's right. I mean, man is a special case in regard to nature. He's obviously part of nature in a way. You know, we're natural creatures. On the other hand, we're the one creature that can see ourselves outside of nature too, which is why. You know, I mean, one could make the argument that a phenomenon like, say, acid rain was completely natural, you know. It resulted from biological beings doing what they were doing, and it's just that I don't think almost anyone really feels that. If they're up hiking in a mountain someplace and there's 10,000 dying spruce in front of them because of some power plant someplace.
How do you think we will... continuing to talk for a little bit in a philosophical vein, how we will experience this, and obviously this, when we talk about the end of nature in the way that you're talking about it, either it has already happened or it is soon to happen, and yet it could well have escaped the notice of many people.
Well,
how and when do you think we'll really begin to feel it?
Feel it in a philosophical sense. Well,
yeah.
I guess that there's so many different kind of paradigms that are involved here. Let's take just one. An awful lot of I would say all Western religion and perhaps a lot of other religions too, although I know less about them, are based on the idea or have at some part of their core the idea that some deity created our planet and has some kind of power over it. If it turns out that we are affecting and changing the most basic and fundamental forces of nature, the things that seem most outside our control, the weather, the temperature, then in some ways that paradigm is going to have to change, I think. And that'll be a big shift for a lot of us to deal with. I don't think it'll hit us all of a sudden, but I think that I'm trying to think of a good analogy. Like, you know, in the 1890s, Frederick Turner announced that the frontier had been closed, you know, in America, and that we'd gone all the way across the country, and that sort of epoch was over. And I don't think that we, and I doubt that anyone right at the time sort of realized it or felt it, but in retrospect, it's become clear what an important force the frontier was in American history and how its closing changed our culture. Maybe this is in some way an analogous event.
I think at one point you write one of the results is that we can no longer imagine that we are part of something larger than ourselves. And I think that that's if that is true, that comes to pass, that puts us at a very dangerous point.
Yes, I completely agree with that. If we're, that's one of the sort of restraints on our actions, it seems to me. The idea that that there are other things that are created as well and that have sort of value in and of themselves. And if we become the sort of undisputed dominators of the planet, then I write a little bit about genetic engineering in the book, which seems in an odd way to me connected to some of these environmental problems, because I'm afraid that the way that we'll attempt to overcome things like the greenhouse effect is through more and more management and domination of the planet instead of less. That we'll say, well, look, if we've made it hot, now let's create plants and animals that can stand, you know, 130 degree heat or whatever. And those tools and techniques are quickly becoming within our grasp. And that if we follow that path, which seems to me the obvious and easy path for us to follow, we're on a kind of spiral into an ever more human-dominated world.
Yeah. To talk a little bit about the physical reality that has brought us to this philosophical point, you present the information that has been gathered over some period of time about the greenhouse effect and about global warming, which are really not really new ideas. Some scientists have been looking at these things for a long time.
Sure, the first scientist to sort of speculate about it was in the 19th century, and his estimates are surprisingly close to the sort of current computer models about what increases in carbon dioxide will do to the temperature.
That we are, as a result of burning of fossil fuels, production of the fluorocarbons, the CFCs, we are getting to a point where we have substantially altered the atmosphere of the entire Earth, and that the consequence, many people say, is that we are moving towards a warming of the Earth. That is the global average temperature, it's been projected, will increase between 3 and 8 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yes, as I say in the book, it's very uncertain about exactly what will happen. Most scientists seem to agree on the direction of change in terms of warmth, although there are some who disagree and think that we could produce a sort of greenhouse ice age. That's a distinctly minority viewpoint. The point is, however, that we've just introduced an immense amount more energy into the system, you know, by trapping all this warmth that would otherwise radiate back out to space, and that therefore something is likely to happen. And most people think it'll be a warming of the planet.
Now, the kind of change that we're talking about, it's going to be gradual. It's not something like that's going to happen overnight.
Well, it's going to be pretty quick. If the estimates are correct, there's one scientist, Jim Hansen at NASA, who said that the average summer of about 10 years from now may closely resemble the summer we had in 1988, when it was, at least here, too damn hot. And so depending on one's definition of quick, that seems pretty quick to me.
Well, I guess that goes back to what I was saying at the beginning about how, you know, we... about our ideas about time and how about how things are going to take forever, and that maybe that is why this discussion doesn't seem to have much of a sense of urgency about it.
Yeah, I mean, people are used to the idea that natural change takes place at a so-called glacial pace, and that may very well turn out not to be true. We may, you know. We're talking about changing, according to a lot of estimates, changing the Earth's climate at a rate 10 to 60 times faster than it's ever changed during human history.
Well, you know, what confuses me, and what I think confuses a lot of lay people when we talk about issues like this one, is that we, and I think often in the media community, I mean, we're guilty of reinforcing it, is what we do is we present people with the battle of the scientists. We go out and get one scientist who says one thing, and then we go out and get another scientist who says the opposite, and then I think, what we've ended up telling people essentially is nothing. And so it seems that the discussion still does seem to have much urgency to it, and that we continue to have scientists who will say about global warming and about acid rain and about other things, well, the jury is still out. We still don't know.
There, although some of those issues, I mean, for instance, acid rain, I don't think there's anyone still who contends that the jury's out on acid rain. Turns out that the scientists who 25 years ago said that it was destroying trees were absolutely right, and we should have done something 25 years ago, and we still haven't done anything. But perhaps we will now that we have an environmental president. On other questions, yes, there is to some degree still a lot of... I mean, there's an enormous amount we need to know. The problem is that if we wait until we know absolutely everything and until it's completely clear what's going to happen, then we've probably waited too long. And a certain large number of leaders around the world, it seems to me, are beginning to wake up to this. Margaret Thatcher was in New York 2 weeks ago at the UN. Now, she is not, you know, what you would call a kind of left-wing lunatic. In fact, she's been a terrible environmental record and been consistently at odds with environmentalists in Britain. But she's a chemist by training. If someone talks to her about the heat-trapping properties of carbon dioxide, I don't think that her eyes sort of roll back in her head. And she's came out very, very strongly for limitations on CO2 emissions. In fact, 57 of 60 countries at this UN gathering were eager to put some kind of cap on CO2 emissions. The three countries that blocked it were the United States, the Soviet Union, and Japan.
Well, when do you think that we will get to the point where nobody is going to be able to deny this anymore? And at that point, will it be too late to? It's sort of a strange question.
That's a good question, and it's impossible to tell. You know, you can't say 12 years, 18 years. I mean, the science is nowhere near that exact. I do think that we're beginning that there's a real momentum building behind this and a lot of other environmental issues. I think people realize intuitively that the planet is strained to support the population it supports now, that we're probably going to double that population within the next generation, and that the Earth is in desperate straits. And I think people are ready finally to do something about that in a lot of fields.
We're talking this morning with Bill McKibben about his book, The End of Nature. It is published by Random House. We'd be interested in having your comments, too. The telephone number here, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I have a caller we'll get to in just a second. Let me just real quick tell you again The programs for the rest of the week. Tomorrow morning at this part of the show, we'll be talking about Iran with Marvin Weinbaum, a U of I political scientist recently returned from a tour of Tehran and the Persian Gulf. On Friday at 11, we'll talk about children's books with Leslie Edmonds from the School of Library and Information Science. Once again, she'll have a book list for us if you're thinking about books as gifts for the kids in your life. Next week on Monday, we'll talk about the care of houseplants with Marvin Carbonell, professor of floriculture extension at the U of I. On Tuesday next week, the topic sexual harassment with Deborah Allen and Joan Erickson. And the next week, Wednesday, we'll talk about groundwater, the link to sustainable agriculture with Jerry Nelson of the McHenry County Defenders. We're here weekday mornings starting at 10 with 10 different topics for you every week. We always encourage you to call in if you have questions. The number here, 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. And we'll go to a caller right here on line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a number of questions, and if there aren't too many other people waiting, I'd like to ask these.
Sure. Yeah, you're the only one. So
good. Well, a number of things I've jotted down. I've been reading your book, Mr. McKibben. I unfortunately have not finished it yet, and I wish I had before this. But I find it fascinating reading. You mentioned in a couple places, in the book, you're talking about how some of the more radical storms may change as the surface temperature of the ocean increases and as the warmth penetrates farther into the depth of the ocean. And you made a comparison with Hurricane Gilbert. Can you compare Gilbert versus Hugo? You mentioned in there that one person had done a study saying that Gilbert was about at the upper bounds of a storm of that type.
Yeah, I don't think Hugo was quite as strong as Gilbert.
Okay.
I don't know. Precisely, but I think Gilbert represented as strong a hurricane as you could get with temperatures the way they are at the moment. And if they warm significantly, you can get a much, much stronger storm.
Over what kind of a period of time are we talking about storms like that actually changing?
If the Earth temperature goes up in the next 50 years considerably, so will sea surface temperature.
Right. Which brings me to another area here. We talk about the change in temperature being between, 3 and these Fahrenheit.
Right.
Over what period of time is the most likely?
Those figures are for the next, over the course of the next century. There's a lot of debate about when the worst of the warming will kick in. Some people say after 2040, or 2030, something like that. Others think it'll happen more rapidly.
Okay, because there was another point in your book where you were talking about the year 2025 seeing some significant losses in shoreline, even, for instance, in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what that was based upon.
Well, those are all, you see, all these studies assume a certain increase in temperature by the year 2025. This is what will happen. And as I say, the science is remarkably unexact. And in a way, that's the scariest part of the whole thing. If we knew precisely what was going to happen, if we could say, 2060, the temperature will be so-and-so at this and this place, then we could take, it would be bad enough, but we'd at least know what we were planning for and could take the steps to deal with it. Since we don't know that, it seems to me all the more reason to try to slow things down as much as we can.
Is there some publication currently out that actually takes these different studies and compares them in a chart form or even in a discussion and says, well, if you take this one and take this worst case scenario?
The EPA did a pretty good. It's referred to in the I'm forgetting the name of it at the moment, but it's referred to, I think, in the acknowledgments of the book.
Okay.
The EPA has done did a huge report for Congress last year. It came out, the first part came out in the fall of last year and the second part in the spring of this year. And I think the part that came out in the fall of last year had a lot of, talked about the various computer models and gave some of their, in fact, it talked a lot about the various computer models for the Great Lakes area.
Mm-hmm.
And gave examples of what they were predicting.
Was this damage to the ocean front by 2025, was that based on a 1 meter rise?
I can't remember, but I imagine it probably was.
Because that seems to be kind of the base figure there.
Yeah, that's sort of close to the consensus.
Because, I mean, that's you're talking about an awful lot of loss of land in, say, Florida. I mean,
you raise
the sea level a meter in Florida, and you're going to lose a tremendous amount of that.
I was on a reporting trip earlier this year to the Maldives Islands in the Indian Ocean. Incredibly beautiful archipelago of about 1,500 islands, most of them about the size of a football field. They're truly paradisical, and they're ecologically sound in a lot of ways. You know, the people fish with hand lines, and the fish population is as healthy as it ever was, and so on. Unfortunately, these islands are all about 5 feet above sea level, and they're going to be in desperate trouble if the sea level rise of anything like the kind that people are talking about takes place.
You mentioned also that the ice that's currently floating in the ocean would not have any effect on that, except that wouldn't that actually have a slightly ameliorating effect, in that frozen water, it does have a greater volume. If you melt that, all that sea ice, it's actually going to...
It might, I suppose, have a... I'm not sure.
Okay, I mean, very minor, but...
Yeah.
Studies that you know of that that start to take a look at if these things do, in fact, continue, where are the better places to live? I mean, if you're planning to live someplace, where should you head for?
Well, there was a lot of sort of 10 years ago or 5 years ago when people were talking about the greenhouse effect, there was a lot of discussion of kind of winners and losers in the greenhouse world and things. I think the sort of consensus now is that every place is going to be in big trouble if we have these kind of changes, and that it's impossible to really predict where you know, will be most stable.
Because some places
are obviously... There's some indication that temperature changes might be greater at higher latitudes, and that...
You mean more radical?
Yes. Yes, and that more tropical latitudes might have less absolute increase in temperature.
So that we would see still drastic winter, or we see more drastic winters and more drastic summers, and say in Canada than...
No, that you'd see warmer weather year round.
Okay, so you would not, you don't expect to see harsher winters out of it.
No, although, as I say, there are people who look into the numbers and see the possibility for harsher winters.
Are there effects that we see now other than acid rain and that, but I mean, other meteorological effects that we can see now? We can look back 25 years and say, oh, well, this has changed now.
There's some evidence that sea level has begun to rise in the last 15 years. There's a study, two University of Toronto researchers reported this spring, I think, that said that they had measured sea level at, I don't know, 468 locations around the planet, and that they were detecting now noticeable rises in sea level.
So that...
That would tend to be a confirming theory. Yeah.
And we would expect these things to start increasing much more rapidly. So
yes, that's correct.
If we use the...
if these models are at all correct, that's right.
If we use the year 2000 or something, people will start to say, gee, my doc seems to be...
Maybe.
One last question. Sure. I'm taking a class on futurism, so this is one reason that I'm real interested in this, because it's a topic for me. If you were to... An awful lot of people are extremely skeptical of this, or say, well, there's nothing I can do about it, or, everybody disagrees. As David was saying, you can find... seem to be able to find a scientist to disagree with any other scientist, kind of like lawyers, you always find your own experts. What if you had one thing to say to somebody to try and get your point across here, to convince them to at least seriously consider this, what would you say to them?
Well, I'd say that if you had gone at the top of a mountain in some remote place in 1960 and taken an air sample and kept it in a bottle someplace, you went up to the same mountain now and took another air sample, you'd have dramatically different levels of gases in the atmosphere. But the composition of the atmosphere is changing, and that's beyond question. And that it's only logical to assume that that will have some effect, since the composition of the atmosphere is important.
That's a good point. I was in Monterey, California, back in the late 60s. And went up on top of a mountain. It's called Chew's Ridge, where there was a Forest Service lookout station. There was a gentleman who spent all his summers up there. He was a rather elderly gentleman who had been doing that for I don't know how many years. And he pointed up toward up the valley towards San Jose and that area, and he commented how every year he could see the smog and the pollution creeping farther and farther and farther down. He just watched that over his life.
And it's the stuff you can't see, too, that'll get you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank
I'm looking forward to finishing your book, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. This morning, our guest is Bill McKibben. We're talking with him about his book, The End of Nature. Bill McKibben is a journalist. He has done a lot of writing for The New Yorker. His work has also appeared in the New York Review of Books, in the New York Times, and other publications. The End of Nature is published by Random House. If you have questions, comments, please do give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We could go on for such a long time to talk about what seem to be the likely consequences of global warming, and it seems that there would be no part of the Earth, no aspect of life, virtually, that would be untouched. Humans and their life, agriculture, the wild animal population, sea level, just. You could go.
That's correct.
You could go on and on.
We're talking about a one of the kind of baseline systems of the biosphere, the weather and climate, and if one changes it dramatically, one changes everything dramatically.
You talk about in our response to this, you seem to be saying that we're presented with two possible paths. One would be the path that goes along the line that says technology can fix problems technology has created, and that is the way that we can manage to dig ourselves out of this. So, which means essentially on that branch of the path is we continue to change the world, to continue to try to change the world, to cope with changes that we have already brought about. But the other path is that instead of trying to change the world even further, that what we could try to do is essentially is to change ourselves, to change our ideas about economic growth, about what it means, about how you measure it, about what kind of life we want to live. You know, that nasty word, lifestyle.
Way of life.
Yeah, prefer. Yeah. That we could change our way of life. So here we're presented with this. We're sort of at this point in the road where not too far down the road, there are these divergent paths.
That's right. It seems to me that there is a choice to be made, and that we could decide, really for the first time, to restrain ourselves in both our numbers and our way of life, to live a little bit more humbly, so that the rest of creation has some chance at things as well. Because otherwise, our domain, in every way, keeps expanding constantly. And pretty soon, I think there will be nothing sort of left but us in our sort of planet-sized zoo.
Hmm. Well, let's go on here, talk with some other folks.
Sure.
I'll go to the toll-free line, I think, next. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm really glad you wrote this book. I'm excellent.
Thank you.
You wrote this book. The comment that I want to make is that the discussion about the arguments about the extent of damage just drives me up the wall. Because it reminds me of it's like a bunch of people on a runaway train that are arguing about the probable death rate instead of trying to stop the train.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're spending, like you said, 25 years ago, they said acid rain is affecting our rainforest and our, you know, the forests of Canada, do-da-do-da, fine. Nobody did anything about it.
Right.
And now we're stuck with a bunch of dead trees and the ecosystem is seriously damaged and is among the walking wounded at best. The people that need most to hear about this, I think, are busy out there consuming. Right.
Yes, well, there's always that.
Even as we speak. That's my concern. You said at the very beginning of the program that in a way we're tied to nature, in a way we're part of nature, in a way we're not. And I take some umbrage at that because I think we are inextricably part of nature. Mm-hmm. You cannot talk about the ecosystem. You cannot talk about the planet
without talking about our effects on it. That's
exactly
right.
Because we're part of it. We're part of the chain. Unfortunately,
you know,
we're the end of the chain.
I think that there's a chance for real kind of political action on these things. I think that people. One thing that really encouraged me is not only. I mean, the book got quite a good reception here in this country, but they're publishing it next year in 12 or 13 foreign countries, and I'm going to England in a month to promote it and things, and I get the sense that the rest of the world is perhaps ahead of America, or at least large parts of the rest of the world are ahead of America in beginning to deal with these issues. And, you know, one reason, for instance, that Margaret Thatcher can deal with it perhaps is that she's a chemist, but another is that that environmentalists have begun to become a very important part of the political landscape in Great Britain, and she's responding to their concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, that in a way, there was a sort of environmental movement growing up in the late 60s and early 70s, and even through the 70s. And then it was interrupted quite dramatically by the Reagan administration,
mm-hmm.
which was remarkably anti-environmentalist and oblivious to these sort of issues, and that there's a chance that that interruption is now over and we're ready to go back and in even bigger ways to thinking about the environment.
Well, I would hope that sometime during this program you would address the issue of how can I help?
Sure. That's a good question.
Good. I would say
that there are, you know, several ways. I mean, the first talking specifically about the greenhouse effect, the most obvious thing that people can do personally is to figure out a way to use a lot less fossil fuels, heat their homes less, drive their cars less, drive smaller cars. But once, you know, you're sitting there in your house shivering a little bit, it's equally important or more important